What kinds of powder, Rashi?
Well, gun, for example, or maybe talc, or, I don't know, chili.
Well, back up, what was that first one, gunpowder?
I said chili last, let's focus on that one.
We don't have a scale about that can weigh anything like that.
What's I guess I have to eyeball it then, see you outside.
Wait a minute. I think Rashi is stockpiling gunpowder for the 4th of July.
I thought he said chili powder.
I don't know. I don't trust him either. I don't trust him either. I'm going to go out and take a... Whoa!
Are you all right?
Did you hear that?
I did.
Oh my God,
the barn is smoking.
Rashi, are you all right?
Yeah, I'm fine. I really shouldn't use that scale. God bless America. Happy 4th of July, everybody.
I'm Misty Lee.
And we are coming
to you. Not the monkey formerly known as Rashi.
Rashi, I think you better get... You're all charred up there. I think we need to put you in the washing machine and then break out the sewing kit.
Whew, I'm going to go take a bath. It smells like burnt cotton in here.
Oh, boy, he's... I see Rashi's getting ready for his usual 4th of July atrocities.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, you can't... That. I think it was a few years ago we were in, was it Wyoming? And he found that store that sold nothing but taxidermy and fireworks.
Yes.
I've never seen him happier.
He was like, this is heaven.
Dead animals and things to make animals dead with. He was pulling two shopping carts full of crackers and screamers and Roman candles and everything.
And in the third, he had a stuffed yak.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Speaking of taxidermy, we're back from London. Rashi and myself are
yes.
back. And
How
Hobart. What?
How was that?
It was fine. It was fine, except we're not allowed back in the British Museum anymore. Either the Natural History Museum or its offshoot in Tring.
Oh, my God.
Tring, too. Oh, my.
Tring, yeah. It's a lovely little village, and Rashi and I went there with Hobart, I'm not going to say what happened, but... We're not allowed back in there anymore, and we sincerely apologize for the state we left there. Taxidermy thylacine, but the less said about that, the better. England was fine. It was great. It was beautiful. I was actually writing a project when I was over there, so there were a few days when it just poured rain, and even in the rain and the fog, and London is beautiful, so I just stayed in my room and wrote, you know, from dawn to dusk, which was good because I was really jet-lagged, and then on a free day, I went over to the Barbican Museum, and to see their new animation exhibit.
That must have been great.
Yeah, it's called Watch Me Move, and it's a whole history of animation from, you know, just from zoetropes to Pixar movies of today.
What a cool thing. Now, well, your sister's museum, he went over there with his sister, who's one of the curators at the DIA,
yeah.
Detroit Institute of Arts. Will they be the first in the U.S. to have this exhibit?
I think so. In the U.S., know? Maybe not in the in the Western Hemisphere. I believe it goes to Calgary next.
Okay.
And from there, I think Taiwan, and these shows are bought years in advance and planned out years in advance. So I think sometime after that, it may be coming to Detroit. I'm not exactly sure. It is going on tour, and it's going to be traveling around the world, and it's a great exhibit, and there's some fascinating stuff. And I think that every major animation creator throughout the world is well represented.
Yeah, you said it was a world exhibit, so it's not just American, I'd hope, but I hope there's lots of Japanese and European and all of those areas represented, right?
Uh-huh. It spans the world. It goes everything from what you think it would, like with Disney. You know, there is a smattering of Disney where they show some of the early features and the early shorts, and I believe they showed the entire... There is one exhibit where they showed the entire skeleton dance, which was Walt's earliest Silly Symphony.
Yeah.
And there's and it's split up into different categories and different themes. And there's one, there was one huge room devoted to characters, because as the technique of animation evolved, the audiences wanted something more than just a character that moved around like a...
They want someone they can identify with or at least recognize.
Yeah, and the character exhibit was was kind of split up. One was like superheroes, and then the other one was more traditional cartoon characters. So superheroes ran the gamut from everything from the Incredible Hulk, not the cartoon, not the cell animated cartoon, but the CGI Hulk that was in the movies. They show the process of how a CGI character is created and incorporated with live action, and they use the Hulk as that example. To things like Akira and Sailor Moon and Princess Mononoke, they were in the heroes part. And the characters featured things like the Aardman animation characters Creature Comforts, Wallace and Gromit, to American characters like Tom and Jerry and Yogi Bear and The Simpsons.
Really comprehensive.
Bugs Bunny, everything like that. And there were a few places where they just showed whole cartoons. You know, they showed the whole cartoon Duck a Muck in one segment. You know, I guess that was to show like the traditional Hollywood, you know, cartoon. And Duck a Muck is a great cartoon. It's one they always show. You go to every film festival, they always show Duck a Muck.
It's well representative of the animator.
And I guess, you know, on the one hand, you know, you go through something like that, and I'm a fan of certain types of animation, and you always say, well, I would love to see a little bit more of this, a little less of this. But you have to look at it as sort of a well-rounded history of animation. And what I really liked about it was it didn't skew too young for the kiddies. It's not the sort of exhibit you can take the kids to and just drop them at and think they're going to be entertained for a couple of hours. It's something that that animation students should see, also animation historians and film historians, but also, you know, if parents go, they should go with their kids, because there's some stuff that they might need to explain to them, and it's presented in a scholarly light. So there may be a few things that a parent might take umbrage to and say, like, well, I don't think that's appropriate, but if they go with a kid, then that's
Mommy, what's fine. Fritz the cat?
Yeah, I don't recall seeing any Fritz there. He might have been there, but there was some Ralph Bakshi in there.
Oh yeah,
yeah. There was actually a really good clip from Heavy Traffic, and Bakshi was represented throughout. So was Tim Burton, in fact, who started his career, of course, as an animator. Yeah. They showed the entire film Vincent at one point.
I love Vincent. That's great.
It's a good example of stop motion. It's a good example of his design and his directing, because he's doing Frankenweenie as a
he's remaking it
remaking it as a stop motion film. So that'll be out when a year or two, I guess.
That's what I'd imagine. It takes a while.
Even when you get the go ahead on a stop motion feature, it's like 2.5 to 3 years before it comes out.
Yeah, it takes a while. Well, I mean, I remember when we went into the Robot Chicken Studios.
Yeah,
they were working on stuff pretty far in advance.
Right.
And you would think, you know, it's so pop culture oriented would think, my gosh, you know, like they probably would throw these things out pretty quickly. Oh, not so much.
Wow.
You know, they've got little cubicles and cubby holes where people are in there literally between blankets moving things around and clicking. And they're doing a lot of work all the time.
And they were actually on a staggered shift, I think, with Moral Oral. Mm-hmm. Like Moral Oral was off for a few months, then they were animating Robot Chicken, and once Robot Chicken goes on hiatus, then they were going to go back and do more Moral Oral.
Right, and then we were at that other stop motion place that did your Jing.
The Jingle Bell stop motion model. That was Mark Caballero's group. They were doing the animated in the stop motion interstitials for Chowder. Yeah,
they gave me a little bean.
Wow.
Yeah,
a sing bean.
I love stop motion.
Fascinating.
It just every time I've seen it done or performed or come on a set where they were doing it, it's just you know amazing. It's just you know every tiny little detail has to move in
so slowly.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So what was your favorite thing at the exhibit?
There were a couple of large Aardman figures on armatures. And those look fascinating to show how they worked and they were put together. Unfortunately, there was no Charlie Bowers in the exhibit. And I would have liked to have seen him represented. And maybe there was, but I might have missed it. But Charlie Bowers was an amazing animator in the 30s who did stop motion and live action together. Mm-hmm. And he did that in several films. He also did that cartoon you like, The Wild Oysters, with the mouse being menaced by oysters and come out of their shell.
It's hysterical.
And they move around like slugs and they beat up the mouse.
Have you seen that?
No, I haven't. That sounds awesome.
Oh, my God.
Charlie Bowers had this great sensibility and this great sense of design. He was like a Dr. Seuss type cartoonist, and he did this one about a bird, a metal-eating bird, where he plays a hunter who goes off and discovers this metal-eating bird, and he feeds it an entire car, and the bird eats an entire car, you know, in stop motion.
Piece by piece.
You know,
wow.
Yeah.
It is beautiful, and it is so fluid, and it's so remarkable. And weren't you saying that his stuff was never properly archived? They just kept either destroying or recording over it because he never really sold well, and they uncovered this in France? Is that where they uncovered this movie?
I think he was just sort of ignored here. I don't think he could get a good distributor. Or every time he got a distributor, it always sort of fell through, or people would put some money into his stuff, and it never seemed to catch on. His stuff, he was more or less an independent, and so his stuff kind of lagged behind Disney and everybody else's. But they did revere his stuff in France, and they saved his stuff in France, where a lot of it over here was just destroyed or, you know, chopped up or ignored or something.
Boy, those oysters are such assholes.
Yeah.
More assholes of the animal kingdom.
Oh, yeah. They're spectacular.
Obnoxious little oysters, yeah. Yeah, I don't know all that much about Charlie Bowers, but I think he's a fascinating subject for you know, for study, because as with any art form, there are guys that you know who become huge successes, like Walt Disney and Walter Lantz, and the Looney Tunes director certainly became famous, you know, in later years, Hanna-Barbera, who were amazingly successful. And then there are guys like Charlie Bowers who just, you know, go out and give it their all and come up with some amazing looking stuff, and they just slip through the cracks for whatever reason.
Yeah. It's really beautiful work. I highly recommend it if you guys can see it. And Wild Oysters is ridiculous. Those oysters are so rude.
Yeah.
They are. They're hysterical. One of them gives a raspberry.
Yeah.
It's about a little mouse that's just trying to go out and get some milk for his family.
That's some raspberry from an oyster, too, because they're all tongue.
Oh, the little tongue comes right out. Yeah, it comes way far out.
Yeah, and there are these thugs. They live in oyster shells, and then they creep around,
and they beat up this mouse. They're just jerks.
Yeah, I was looking at some stop motion earlier tonight. I was looking at some George Pal puppetoons.
Puppetoons.
Oh, yeah.
Those were great.
Sir.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Again, you know, I've heard reports that he had a huge studio in here in Hollywood, and just employed hundreds of technicians to do. It wasn't so much stop motion; it was like replacement part animation.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
like
it's
the
still,
mouse and stuff.
Yeah, it's still well. It's more like the heads. You know, they would carve dozens and dozens of heads,
which just came up for sale recently. Some puppetoon figures.
Oh yeah, they were
salivating over those.
Oh, they were all from the Jasper cartoons, which is you know, that was probably his most consistent character. He did not. Pal did not have a lot of recurring characters in his short puppet films. He had a character called Jim Dandy, and he had kind of Punch and Judy, who were kind of like little boy and girls. But he mostly had this character Jasper, who was a little African American boy who lived in a, you know, rural setting down south, and he was usually victimized by
a trickster scarecrow
who was always taking advantage of him.
But what was his name? Scarecrow's name?
Professor Scarecrow.
That's right.
And he had a little crow called Blackbird who sat on his shoulder.
Mm-hmm.
And of course they talked in, you know, black dialect and everything. So Pal was, you know, Pal thought this was sort of, he was from Hungary and he thought, well, this is an American comic type. You know, I can kind of make fun of these characters because, you know, these are stock characters in American humor. And it's like, well,
not so much, but
not so much. He kind of missed, you're not going to see these anymore because they have, you know, racist
undertones.
They
just kind of missed a mark.
Yeah.
However, that being said, they do have some merit.
Yeah.
You know, and they are entertaining.
And the music, the fact that they scored all of these to music is unbelievable.
Yes,
so.
And the music is really good.
Yeah. The music is great, and then when you figure they're moving line after line of dolls and just replacing all the heads on them and in sequence, and they're dancing and moving up and down and everything. It's really remarkable.
Yeah. Some of those, it's just, they're so elaborate too. Mm-hmm. The amount of work and time and craftsmanship that goes into those things, it's just amazing.
Yeah, and I've never seen any of the models that came up for sale, and then just a whole bunch of Professor Scarecrow and Jasper models came up, and once the bidding went over 13,000, I just said, too rich for my blood. Maybe whoever's buying them will put together dioramas or sell the pieces or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Or maybe they'll just go to a museum or something so people can enjoy them.
Switching gears a little bit, there was a Nessie sighting
Yes, there
wasn't
was.
There?
Yes, just the other day. I'm not responsible for that. I did not leave England. So the farthest north I got was Tring on the train. I did not go up to Scotland, so you can't blame that one on me
or
Rashi.
I tried to catch you, and you stayed true.
Yes.
Yes, that was my big secret plan.
No.
I brought up Nessie to see if you would slip, and you didn't go to Scotland after all, huh?
If Nessie appeared and we had gone up there, you know it would have been Rashi and a couple of inner tubes.
Yes.
Creating a hoax.
And his little middle finger.
Yes, creating a hoax. No, but I did hear that the monster had put in an appearance. And
well, what was the story with that, do you know?
It was...
Close-up picture of a driftwood.
some people in Foyers, which is a little village near Loch Ness, saw it.
Garter snake on a green screen.
Yeah. They just saw it swimming around the water. They saw the humps going up and down, saw the neck. And you know, for a few minutes. And, of course, no one thinks to get a camera or whip out the cell phone.
Ever.
You know, there it goes. It's like,
which is remarkable because my sister and I drove by a hand-painted sign the other day that said Chuck Norris rules. And the first thing she did was grab her camera. So why someone is like, oh my God, it's the Loch Ness Monster. No, don't bother photographing it.
Did you at least go through the museum?
Yes.
The Nessie Museum and the big statue of Nessie.
It's out there floating in the pond out in front. Yeah, had to do that. Yep. Bought the little plastic souvenirs and everything.
Mm-hmm.
It was like, you know, years ago when I was in Tasmania, you know, I had my one little encounter, you know, with the Tasmanian tiger. And it's like, I was so busy getting out of the way of the kangaroos charging, it never occurred to me they were running from something. Mm-hmm. And by the time I saw what it was like,
Sean.
Off into a swamp.
Mm-hmm.
So
you have had some amazing experiences.
Yeah. Just, you know, you have to be at the right place at the right time. I was never taken aboard a spaceship or anything like that.
Not yet.
No, but, you know.
There's still time.
There's still time. There's still time.
You're sort of an Australian adventurer, though. I mean, that's kind of where your explorer's heart truly lies.
Yeah. I love tramping around the wilderness down there.
You do.
Whether it's up north near Kununurra or down in Cradle Mountain, Tasmania. Mm-hmm.
You were just talking this morning about the time you outran pirates. That wasn't in Australia, but...
That was in Indonesia.
Has he talked about that on here before?
I don't think so.
What, outrunning the pirates? Oh, that was fun. You know, it was sailing a schooner around Indonesia, and the captain of our schooner got all upset, and he comes running up, and he goes, "We got to put on some speed. You know, they're pirates after us." And I said, "Where?" You know, an old style schooner. It's like, no, they have motorboats and they have guns. So.
Yeah. They're nasty now.
Yeah. And they had just seen us and they had turned about and were coming after us. They were very curious. And it was like we had to get to port really quick. So we got to port in, I think it was Sulawesi or someplace like that. Uh-huh. And then the pirates, you know, once we got in sight of the port, they kind of backed off and went back to sea, or they leveled off. But later, after I had a chance to look around a little bit, I came back and there were some boats, you know, in the harbor near us, and the high speed boats with kind of rough crews, kind of looking at us, and those are pirates, man. They just come up. That's the modern day pirate. It's not. Yeah. It's not, you know, yo-ho and a bottle of rum. It's guys with, you know, guns and machetes and looking over your boat. What have you got? What can we take? And when are you leaving port? When can we get you? So other than that one little thing where we outran them, I didn't have any more trouble from them. But piracy is a big deal these days.
The muggers of the marina.
Muggers of the marina, basically, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Piracy is a growing field. It's one of the few careers where I think you can actually has some room for expansion. I mean, you know, Somali pirates are doing pretty well.
Mm-hmm. Well, you think.
Well, yeah.
You don't really have the insider track on their goings-on, though.
No.
Rashi might.
Yeah, oh, I'm sure he does. He's got tons of pen pals lately. Tons of mail coming to this house from, you wouldn't believe where. I mean, just the stamps alone, I'm tempted to start an album.
Oh, yeah.
It's crazy.
He's running his consulting service for villains.
Mm-hmm.
He actually did link up with Professor Moriarty in London. We do have footage of that.
Oh, yeah?
We'll have to, And we'll have to run that.
Wasn't near a waterfall, was it?
What?
No, that's...
No, he was consulting on that, you know, but
he was working on some sleeper robot for somebody a couple weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
He was testing something on Superica.
I don't know.
Superica said he was queasy for a couple days, but I didn't really hear any more about it. And I sound like a negligent mother, don't I?
How did Superica's date go? Because I heard about that on the last podcast.
He didn't get home till dawn with a huge smile on his face, so I'm assuming very well.
Very well, okay.
And he said shut his cell phone off yesterday, so I guess she's calling and calling.
Okay.
That's our son.
Yeah. Yeah.
Superica?
Talk about a negligent mother.
You're puppy.
I don't want you breaking hearts.
No, puppy, I won't do that. But I don't like it when they are too clingy.
Too clingy. Yeah, see, there you go.
Okay. All right, Superica. He's a little Lothario, that one.
Takes after you.
What?
He takes after you.
What else were we talking about today? Bigfoot's in the news, and since we're talking about cryptids.
Yeah. Wow.
There's some TV show, like, hunting for Bigfoot. You know, and every week
If they find him, they're canceled. What a stupid idea.
Well,
what a totally stupid... You remember that show Monster Quest?
There you go.
On the Discovery Channel?
No.
Biggest blue
History
ball...
Channel.
Oh, History Channel?
Yeah,
really?
Yeah.
Biggest blue ball of a program ever.
Yes.
If they ever found anything, and I know you probably had to turn my volume down because I got so hyper about this, but if they ever find anything, you're going to hear about it before the show airs.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's like, you know they don't find anything, so they're just wasting an hour of your life.
Yeah.
It's the dumbest. I mean, it's really cool to watch the instruments being set up and to learn a ton of background about the character, or specifically the cryptid, because Monster Quest was all cryptids.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's just like they're just gonna stiff you.
It's just like the ghost hunter show.
Yeah, because if they find Bigfoot, they're not going to wait 20 weeks in syndication to show you. They're going to show you that night. Yeah. They're going to show you footage of Bigfoot in the Sierras.
Breaking
or
news,
wherever.
Bigfoot has been sighted in the mountains.
And here's footage of it.
Absolutely, that's what you're going to get.
Yeah.
You're not going to get, let's just hang on to this for 4 or 5 weeks so that we can get, air this to an audience of 250,000.
Uh-huh.
No, that's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. That's big news. So what's going on with Bigfoot in the news?
Oh, there are people who are looking for him, and they're trying to track him down, and
so how long is this show?
I don't know. I've been so disinterested, and I haven't even checked it out. And
you're disinterested? That's bad.
I've kind of gone the route of Bigfoot. I have to say I'm not a Bigfoot believer.
Better the route
anymore.
Up than the way up.
Yes.
Yes.
I mean, I look at it this way. I keep analyzing, I keep going back to, where's the fossil evidence? Where is some evidence of Bigfoot's passing.
They have these giant footprints.
Well, where's the skeleton? Where's a fossil record of it? I mean,
Toe bone, yeah.
Yeah, and you can say, oh, well, and I've seen all the footage, they try and put out, and they say, well, here's a deer we found dead in the woods, and we set a time-lapse camera here to show how the ants and the bugs and everything strip a deer down to nothing. And, okay, that's fine, but I just can't believe that, they haven't found anything.
Yeah.
And if it hasn't been lying on a ground, here's another thing that I keep thinking of. If you went to Africa and if you were in equatorial Africa and you shot a leopard or something and you went through its stomach and see what it ate, chances are it was eating small primates. Mm-hmm. Maybe even like a chimpanzee or a mandrill or something, or baby, one of those. They prey on them,
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's say they're Bigfoot creatures out there. Let's say, their young are susceptible to predation by large carnivores in that area. Well, we've shot all the grizzly bears and cougars and jaguars and everything throughout the West over the last 100 years, and I never heard of anybody finding any remains of an animal like that in their stomach.
Right.
You figure that they would have, if they had family units, occasionally the young would be preyed upon by other animals.
For example, my favorite monstrous mythological legendary sort of creature was the giant squid. Uh-huh. There was proof of giant squids in whale stomachs,
sure.
And lesions on their faces from battles and stuff.
Yeah.
We just can't see them because they're too deep and they don't live that long, but we find the dead ones and
sure.
We have evidence of them.
Yeah, and the one time on Monster Quest where they did find something, it was in the Tasmanian Tiger episode. Mm-hmm. They were hunting around up in the hills and they found a footprint, which they said, this matches exactly the footprints we have in museums. So, did they find one? Did they get one on film? No, but they found a fresh footprint in an area where they were known to exist at least 75 years ago. So theoretically, it is possible to think they still inhabit.
And they found a footprint of something that they've seen leave a footprint before. Not
yes,
a footprint
exactly.
Of something they've
and
never they, witnessed leave a footprint.
And there are dozens of them stuffed in museums and there are photos of them. So it's like the Eastern Panther, everybody will say the Eastern Panther. Like the mountain lion in Massachusetts is extinct, but they find them occasionally, or they see them in Pennsylvania, or one of them gets hit by a car or something like that, and that's not a big deal because they were there originally, and theoretically it's possible to think they came back. What?
Maybe you should just turn my microphone on. He's so loud.
He just doesn't like mythological creatures. He can't chase them.
Mm-hmm. He is just not
chasing them in his dreams.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, he is like out. It's been an amazing week around here. I mean, we've had, my sister was here for 4 days, and we've had, you know, people just in and out, and handymen here. We put a bunch of stuff in the attic and then tore down half the backyard and put up a pool, as you guys just saw.
Yeah.
When you came in. I mean, it has just been insanity.
One thing after another.
Poor little dogs are just so wiped out, and our niece is here. Kala! Yeah? Say hi!
Rashi didn't have you packing powder down into tubes, did he?
Were you helping Rashi make the fireworks?
Maybe.
Okay, that doesn't bode well.
Boy, that's a pretty cagey answer. Yeah.
Okay, that's a yes.
Yes, it is.
She's obviously been bribed.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't need my lie detector skills to tell there's some crap going on in the barn.
No.
So everybody, this is Kala. She's our niece, and she'll be with us for the next 3, I think, podcasts.
Mm-hmm. Oh, very nice.
Say hello to our dozen of listeners.
Yes.
Hi.
Welcome.
Let's see, turning to the world of comics, I guess we should comment on this. Everybody's asked me what I think of the
Harley?
Well, the DC Comics reboot.
Yeah.
I thought it was going to be specifically Harley, because that's what I've been hearing the most about.
Yeah, I've been hearing about that a lot.
I've been seeing all these fan, you know, things rise up. Mm-hmm. Return to the real Harley. Like, yeah. All of a sudden, I'm like...
Well, people are kind of up in arms over what Harley is going to look like, and it's like, well, you know, try something new, you know.
Yeah.
I don't care. I mean, look how many times Supergirl has changed her outfit. She's gone from, you know, having like the little skirt outfit to the 70s hot pants outfit to the little skirt outfit that she had on the animated series to whatever it is she's wearing now. I've lost track or anything, but yeah. Harley's look is very extreme.
I just heard originally DC was doing that whole girls wear pants advertising thing, and now you see Harley Quinn and she's barely wearing anything, so I was just concerned.
She's wearing dental floss.
Yeah.
And well, she's wearing like a bustier, and then I guess they're like bikini shorts or something like that. But, and I haven't really seen a good shot of her. There's just been that one shot of her that's on the cover of Suicide Squad.
So, and that's just a cover done by a different artist. We don't even know if that's going to be the interior.
And I don't know what's going to happen to her in the last pages of, the last issues of Gotham City Sirens. I assume Sirens is going on kind of permanent hiatus, and that all the characters from Sirens are being split up into different books.
Like, yeah.
Ivy's in Suicide Squad.
Yeah,
no, Ivy's in, she's in some team book. No, Birds of Prey.
Ivy's in Birds of Prey.
Mm-hmm. Catwoman's getting her own book again, and mm-hmm. Harley's in Suicide Squad.
Yeah.
And it looks like Harley is getting even more demented in Gotham City Sirens. And I remember when they first offered me the book, they wanted Harley going insane. And, you know, we had talked about some plot line where she gets almost killed and her brain has screwed up permanently. And now she's like a maniac.
So they want her to be more like Joker, I guess?
I guess. So maybe that's what they're doing now. And I don't know. I honestly don't know. I'd have to read Gotham City Sirens when it comes out tomorrow, or, you know, as it winds down its run. I presume it's winding down. That's the other thing is, I don't know what's going on. I've been out of the loop with DC since earlier in the year and concentrating only on
Arkham Asylum,
getting the comic book.
By the way, the comic book I've been really enjoying. And,
thank you.
I love, should I mention the bad guy? Because he hasn't been actually said in the comic, but you know who it is from the outlines and everything.
Of course.
The silhouettes. Hugo Strange is one of my favorite bad guys.
Yes, he's one of mine too.
And I can't wait to see him more in the game.
Yes. Hugo is pretty fantastic. And that's the other thing I was doing over in England. I was testing the game. I didn't get to play the entire game, but I got to see most of the animation all the way through. And there's some knockout stuff, and there's some big surprises. And
very cool.
Some awesome things. So I'm very happy with that, and I'm working really hard to make sure the book is a worthy lead into the game, because there's some stuff I can go into, there's some stuff I can't, and mm-hmm. I just want to make sure that the series stands on its own between the 5 print issues and the 6 or 7 digital chapters, that it all, you know, holds together. But I've been working with Derek Friedolfs on the digital chapters, and he's been doing the scriptings from the my story outline. And
very nice.
Those are really terrific. And even if you've missed those in digital form, you'll be able to get those when the entire book is collected.
Oh, great! So
in October.
Great.
Yeah, I think it'll be, the collected edition will be released just after the game is released. So you'll be able to get the entire lead in with the digital chapters. And and everything. So
how exciting.
Yeah, so that's good. And then I wrapped up my run on Zatanna. That has a few issues left to...
Your last one was 13, right?
13.
Yeah. Lucky.
Which was a little odd because I had just started a big story and then I was told, you know, hey, just do some one-shots. And, you know, because we, you know, we're doing other things with the character. And then before I could even start on that, I had my nasty bout with the sulfa allergy, and that knocked me out for about a week. So
ultimately,
my editor said, just heal up. And I've got some inventory of stories, and I've got a couple of really good writers who are doing one-shots. So I really regret having to bring my run on Zatanna to such an abrupt end. But it was one of those things because, you know, the wheels keep turning, and they have this big relaunch going on.
Well, who knows? Maybe you'll get a chance to pull out some of those strings again sometime.
Oh, I hope so. I mean, there is a graphic novel coming out next year, which is sort of a, you know, the classic Zatanna, classic version of Black Canary.
That looks fun.
On an adventure. And also, during the adventure, you kind of get to see their whole history of being... being friends and how that began.
Yeah, we talked about this because they had leaked a little bit of artwork online about it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, Joe Quinones' artwork. It looks really great.
Yeah, it's really beautiful. I've been looking as the pages are coming in.
Oh, really?
It's pretty.
It's very pretty nice.
Yeah, it's a great story, too.
It's also just 100 pages for me to, you know, there are moments in it where the story is very dramatic and there are moments in it where it's very playful and just where you were able to take your time with it and just explore little character moments between the two of them. And
do you know if it's going to be released as a hardcover?
I believe so.
Very nice.
Yeah.
I can't wait.
It spans a long period in their career, so there are cameos by other members of the DC Universe and who kind of come in and wander in and out. So that's a lot of fun. It's very much classic old school DC. So if you're thirsting for some of that, you can pick it up, I believe, late next year, around middle of the year onto holiday time, 2012.
Before the world ends or after?
What's that?
Before the world ends or after?
I don't know. I tend to think of these stories as taking place anytime. You know, like I ascribe to the old folk tellers theory that these stories took place once upon a time. Not my time, not your time, but one time. Mm-hmm. That's how Aesop would say it. That's how Uncle Remus would say it. That's how... You know, it just once upon a time. I always think of Superman and Batman as sort of extensions of the big man story. You know, like the folklore or fake lore, even if you will, of American literature, which would be things like Paul Bunyan and Storm Along and Pecos Bill, of course, like that. You know, and there is a, and with every one of those heroes, there is a birth story and a death story and a lot of little stories in between. You know, like, you know, there is the death of Paul Bunyan, the death of John Henry, the death of Storm Along, the death of Pecos Bill.
Yeah.
But in between, and those are always told in the same breath as like how the character was born and what they did. But in between, you get all their adventures. So even if you did the same thing with Superman, you can say, okay, he came from Krypton, he worked at the Daily Planet, he was killed by Doomsday or Lex Luthor, who eventually kills him. You know, you could still... But in between, there are all these little fill-in stories.
Yeah.
But that's the thing about an ongoing character. You can't do his definitive death. They have to have these weird temporary deaths where, well, Batman's dying this month, and then we're going to keep him off the books for about a year, and then in the meantime, we're going to have the deaths of Aquaman, Martian Manhunter, Buona Beast, and the Challengers of the Unknown.
Yeah.
Superman's coming back, then Challengers is coming back. Buona Beast isn't never coming back until somebody really wants to revive him, and then...
Yeah, welcome back, Blue Beetle.
Yeah, it's just...
That lasted a long time.
Yeah, everybody dies, and everybody comes back, and...
Well, that's the nature of it. I mean, you know, they've got to perpetuate those characters. And yet at the same time, I kind of hunger to see just a really good story that's, you know, those one-shot stories where everything is as it was from at the beginning.
Yeah.
At the end of the story, but everybody's just a little bit different.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that's such good storytelling is this is what happened today.
Right.
Because that's what life is. You know, you wake up in the morning and when you go to bed, you're just a little bit different.
Well, you see, I think that's sort of where the magic of comic books comes in, and that's one of the things we're kind of losing is I think that there are a lot of really good stories out there that kind of define superheroes one-shot stories that define a superhero at a cataclysmic point in their life, and a lot of writers come into the business saying, I'm only interested in writing the ultimate Batman-Joker fight. It's like,
right, then they're not.
Okay, or I want to change things in a way, you know, I want to do my Killing Joke, I want to do my Watchmen,
that stuff is born out of the artist's ego as opposed to a genuine affinity for the character and really good storytelling skills. If you put an indelible mark on Batman because you've told a remarkable story, like, for example, Frank with Dark Knight.
Yeah.
He made an indelible mark on Batman. He changed a lot of the Batman mythology because he had a good story to tell.
Right, right.
Frank didn't walk in, you know, head on fire like a flaming rhinoceros and say, I'm going to put my mark on Batman. I mean, I don't know. Maybe he did. Something tells me that he just had a really good idea.
Well, he really wanted, yeah, he wanted to shake things up a little bit. He wanted to define, you know, tell a defining story of Batman that didn't have to be subjected to the ongoing monthly continuity, whatever was going on. So he put the story 20, 30 years in the future, that sort of thing.
Well, for example, when you guys came up with the concept for Batman Beyond, did it come up from a place of, oh, I want to do something different. I want the Paul Dini, you know, or whomever version of Batman. Or did you just say, you know, it would be kind of cool. How did that happen?
You really want to know?
No, I'm just asking for my health. Yes, of course I want to know.
We had to sell toys.
Wow.
That's disillusioning,
isn't
it?
That's wonderful.
Great.
No, what happened was...
Good
it's
job.
It's such a romantic idea.
Indeed it is.
Well, it was two parts.
We all just sat here and looked at each other for a second like, oh, okay.
Well, that kind of spoils it a little.
Well, it doesn't really...
He didn't warn us.
It doesn't really...
He didn't warn us.
Yeah. Well, he tried to
Well, every couple of years, they have to refresh the Batman line as far as the merchandise line goes. And once you've got your classic Bruce Timm designed Poison Ivy cookie jar, you're only going to buy one of those. You know, once you've got the classic Batman... animated series Batmobile, you're not gonna, you know, it's a line that always needs to be refreshed. And so one of the ideas that they've always been kicking around is, like, you know, in animation the characters have to be young. You have all these people who are you know, who are always insisting
Batman 90.
Well, yes, right. I mean, you get all these executives who say, you know, we need the characters to be fresh, hip, and young. And it's weird because the executives are none of those things. They just come in and out of fear, they say, you know, kids can't relate to any character that's older than they are. So and teenagers are aspirational. So if we make Batman a kid or at the very most a teenager, then we're able to, you know, do these things with him, and then we're able to sell more because we can do early versions of them. And, you know, that's why you have baby characters. That's why you have baby Looney Tunes and
baby Batman.
Baby, they would do They would
baby
do it.
Batman.
Have you seen that T-shirt? Yeah.
I've seen so many art pitches on baby Batman.
But baby Batman is wrong because his parents were killed when he was how old?
Nine.
Okay, so
eight
baby
nine.
Batman. Would be, I guess he could still be Batman because his dad was kind of Batman.
Well, it doesn't matter how, but it doesn't matter how, the origin doesn't matter. It's a baby in a Batman suit.
There's a t-shirt of that.
Yeah, there was a whole line, DC did a whole line of baby, you know, baby Wonder Woman, baby Batman.
I never saw that.
Was that
years ago.
Like the Geekware one?
It's the, I think it was someone on Threadless actually made it, and it was a sweater, and it was a little Batman, and he's riding a tricycle over a stuffed penguin.
There you go.
Awesome.
It's adorable.
Oh, how cute. Is it a drawing or a photograph?
It's a picture, a t-shirt.
Oh, how
it's
cute.
It's a drawing
yeah.
on a t-shirt.
Someone That's actually cute. Did a development that I thought was actually very creative. I like the designs of Bruce Wayne in high school.
And saw you repost those on Twitter.
Yeah. It was really kind of clever because they had rethought all the characters, all the heroes and villains, and put them in high school. So... Batgirl is kind of like the shy, nerdy girl who's kind of...
That's a good idea.
You know, kind of sticks to herself, but she has this kind of, you know, secret side. And Catwoman was sort of the vamp of the school. Bruce Wayne looked kind of like just regular Bruce Wayne, but just younger. He looked more like the broody young hero. Joker looked like the goth kid. His hair was green and stringy, and he was and Harley was like this adoring. She was a cheerleader. She and Ivy were like the hot cheerleaders, but Harley also was sort of like the Joker's, you know, clearly his main squeeze. And Bane looked like the school bully, and they all looked, you know, redesigned with a great sense of humor to them. But at
who did
the same
this development? This was at Warner Brothers?
So it was either pitched to DC or it was pitched to Warner Animation. I don't know the artists who
really
came up with
idea.
It. You know, it was one of those things where you look at...
It was done by Celeste Green and Jeffrey Thomas.
Oh, there you go. Okay.
Yes, sent to DC.
And it was one of those things where you go, like, I could see this happening, and at the same time, it's like, and yet, I'm a purist, and that's why, and that takes me back to comic book writing. I like writing stories that kind of keep the mythology going in interesting ways.
Yeah.
That are, you know, let's take Batman, let's take Bruce Wayne, let's make him a detective, let's have him do detective things throughout a story, let's, you know, let's do done in ones. And I think as much as fans say they like that stuff, they hated it as much. Because it's like, you don't get any attention for writing the nice little Batman story every month. It's sort of like, that was a nice little Batman story. Eh.
Yeah.
You know, hey, look at this villain. He eats people's faces. Oh, let's read that, you know. Yeah, so.
The event is the water cooler talk.
Yeah, that's the thing.
That's the way it goes.
So, you know, and the same thing with Zatanna. So, you know, I'm sorry if I drug sales down by telling nice little stories, but, you know, that's the thing.
Sounds a little more bitter than I think you are.
Well, you know.
You're not a bitter dude.
Well, what should I by that? You know, I think back on it, if I really wanted that book to sell, she should have been in a refrigerator on page one.
What do you mean in a refrigerator? Cut up and in the freezer?
Yeah.
Just how you like your... He likes his women like he likes his coffee, ground up and in the freezer.
I mean, that is very bitter and very sarcastic, but let's put it out there. What are they, you know, when I don't even know who it was. It was Flash or Green Lantern.
Green Lantern. My Green Lantern, Kyle Rayner.
Yes.
That Gail Simone has a problem with.
He comes home and his girlfriend has been assassinated by one of his enemies and shoved in the refrigerator.
Major force or something like that.
So if I wanted Zatanna to sell, her assistant should be going around, hey, where's Zatanna? Hey, her powers have been stripped. She's been stripped. She's been beaten near death and shoved in the refrigerator. And then the whole story is, how do I get my powers back and how do I empower myself? That was the thing people really didn't, a lot of the people who wrote in didn't like. Mm-hmm. The fact that she was, they say, she's too powerful. I said, well, she's not powerful. She's just confident. It's like, well. So, lesson learned. Okay.
Well, I like your stories, and I think you tell stories about women very well.
Thank you.
Yeah, I really do. I think you write ladies quite well, because you don't go to events. You know, you don't resort to that kind of stuff. You really look at and get to know the characters and their voices, and I really enjoy your writing.
Well, thanks. I mean, I try and write characters like they're real people, and they have kind of like real reactions to things, you know? Mm-hmm. It's like, I know that you know, when sometimes in comics... Sometimes people make a big deal like, oh, we've got a gay couple in this comic, you know. It's like,
so what?
You know, that's a normal part of life, you know.
It sure is.
Zatanna's manager is having a relationship with her lead assistant and kind of cheats on him too. And I thought that was sort of an interesting relationship to get into, because her agent's always looking to trade up on his lover for the bigger, better deal. But again, you know, if the book had run another year, I could have gotten a bit more into the, what was that?
Rashi.
I could have gotten more into the, you know, the byplay of the secondary characters, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things, and we got to wrap this up, but I just, you know, one of the things that I really enjoy about your writing specifically, and I mean, I've told you this off the podcast as well, so this is nothing new, is that as a musician, I find that there's a stark musicality to the way that you write those characters. You really do. You sit there, and there's each one of the characters' dialogue, you know, each one of the characters that you're dialoguing has a cadence. Mm. And you really get in your head a very specific cadence and a meter. And you stick with that. Like, Batman sounds a certain way. And for you, it's Kevin Conroy.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You know, you've said that to me before. He hears Kevin's voice in his head when he's writing that.
Right.
And he'll call me in and we'll read lines sometimes when he's writing things back and forth and say, no, it's da-da-da-da-da-da, boom, and he'll put it down. And it's fascinating for me to watch the creative process. And I don't think it's something that, you know, when you read the final product, you have no idea that he goes through all that. But it really is. Each character almost has a theme song in his head. And watching you do that, do you want to talk about that a little bit? Or do you not even realize you do it? Because you do.
I mean, sometimes it's there kind of unconsciously as I work on the characters. I mean, when I'm writing a character like Harley, I think her dialogue, you know, her dialogue should be free to kind of springboard off into kind of funny directions and then come back to what she's talking
about.
Right,
but the fact that you just used the word springboard and dialogue in the same sentence shows how deeply you know that character, because you see her as a jumping jack, and therefore you write her like a jumping jack, and she's going to make something, she's going to say something quick in a burst, and off she goes. She bursts to you. That's her cadence for
you. Catwoman is a character that I always think of. I think of her in very cat-like terms. Like, when you are playing with a cat, like with a piece of string, the cat will kind of bat at it, you know, or you're kind of scratching the stomach, but at some point the cat's going to grab your hand and scratch, you know? Mm-hmm. So with Catwoman, it's like...
Or just leave you because it's bored.
Yeah, soft, soft, soft. You know, like when she's talking with Batman, something kind of affectionate, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's her self-defense, you know? She is going to... It's like when you're rubbing a cat's belly. She likes it to a point, and then she'll scratch. Mm-hmm. And then she'll want you to do it again, or scratch under her chin.
Oh, yeah.
And then... But that's the way I imagine Selina talks, because she's just used to talking like that, and she doesn't allow people that much in, even Batman. So if the conversation is going all sweet, she'll give him a scratch in some form or another, like bring up something unpleasant or say something deliberately to provoke him mm-hmm. or something. The Joker is, you know, the Joker's kind of like does the things I would never do, but really would like to do.
Yes, yeah. Like drive-through, and I think we said this in a podcast before, a fast food drive-through, and, you know, when they screw up your order, you ask for the manager and just blow them away.
Yeah.
And he
it's like
the
when
Joker
somebody makes you mad and you just go, oh, here I go. Mm. It's like, but usually you don't. So, mm-hmm. but the Joker is sort of like, you know, the one who can kind of get away with that stuff because he just don't care.
Yeah, right. Well, there's a little tidbit into Paul's writing that those of you that listen that are writers might be interested in. I mean, it's just interesting the way that you do that. And I think sometimes the genius things you do, you don't even realize how unusual and brilliant they are. And I hope that didn't make you shy or embarrassed that I'm talking about your writing technique. And I hope it's okay that I did. I mean, you know, did I violate any confidences by saying that? Or?
No, I don't think so. I think I just don't think about it that much. And people have asked me, you know, can you teach me how to do that? Will you teach a class?
Can't.
And it's like, I don't know how to do that. I mean, I think if you're a writer, you understand that instinctively. So you're off writing yourself. And if you have to come to me to explain that, you're just going to leave mystified. Because that's something you have to draw out of yourself.
Well, and not only that, but it's something that you don't even usually realize you do. It's neat to watch as an objective observer.
Right.
Oh. Because it's just your creative process is really fascinating. And you percolate on things and then you just like, boom, you got to get it down. It's really, really fascinating. You're so good at what you
do. Thank you. I mean, I got notes today on a project that I can't talk about and I may not be able to talk about for about a year. But
it's cool.
The notes were all very complimentary. I do have to kind of rework the third act of this thing simply because it just needs to be more of a moment. But the lead character, who is a very well-known character, they said I had the voice down, you know, 110%. And it's a character I've never written before, but instinctively I know because...
You've lived with him in your head for years.
Well, he's an old friend.
He's an old friend. So he's an old friend, and I can just sort of lapse into that and just... I was actually delighted that I could put myself there and have these things come out of his mouth. So, again, you know, it's something that I dress wrote purely to delight the 6-year-old in me. So,
and you did a great job with it.
Thank you.
It's really, really fun.
Yeah, the rewrite's going to take me about a weekend. That's it. And then hopefully it'll be out like about a year from now. Either a year from now or, I don't know, maybe Christmas 2000.
So keep listening here to find out.
That's right.
Yes. Yeah, but that was something. I mean, even like the way I broke that story was like with my sketchbook, where I just sat drawing in my sketchbook stick figures, and you know, for hours at a time. You know, like you'd wake up in the middle of the night. It's like, are you working on the project again? And it's like, yeah, I got some really great gag ideas. So
you took field trips and everything for that one.
Yeah, but it, you know, that's when I'm working on a comedy script, it all starts in my sketchbook, where I just you know, get the characters come to life there. Even if they're just like ratty versions of the characters, that's where the gags come from.
That's where the magic begins, yeah.
I'll close on this story. Years ago, I was, one of my very first jobs, I was working at Filmation Studios, and they were going to do some Tom and Jerry cartoons. So I sat there with a legal pad, and I started sketching as best I could Tom and Jerry, and I'm trying to come up with situations, you know, cat and a mouse, you know, what hasn't been done with them, and, you know, how can I do something funny? And one of the writers walked by my office, and he said, you know, like, what are you doing? I said, drawn up some gag ideas for Tom and Jerry. And it's like, you don't draw, you're a writer. And I said, yeah, but you know, if I work out something fun, I can, you know, write up an idea, or you know, this is how I get the ideas. And the guy said, I'll show you where the ideas come from. And he went to his office. He came back about 3 minutes later with a stack of riddle books. Riddles and jokes for kids. And he goes, that's where your jokes come from.
Oh god.
And take it from me, because I won an Emmy for laughing. You've been a laughing writer. You've been like one of the guys who wrote all the jokes about the guys who come in the window, you know, like, hey, Alan, what is it, Goldie? You know, like
he probably lifted from Robert Orban.
Yeah. I mean, and these were all, and then sure as you're born, on the Tom and Jerry, this rotten version of Tom and Jerry that Filmation did, they had characters like opening windows and talking and yelling at each other and telling riddles, you know, and it's like,
Tom and Jerry don't talk.
Well, they didn't do it. They just had Droopy and Spike and all the other characters do it. You know, that's the other thing about Tom and Jerry. Just because they don't talk means that every character around them should, you know? That's the other thing, you know? Tom and Jerry are way too yakky. You know,
how about you say something nice before we sign off the podcast? Because I think Rashi's blown up the barn, so we could probably use...
What, am I being too bitter?
I think so. You're getting a little mean.
Ooh, well, let me inject some sweetness into this.
Any favorite 4th of July stories?
No.
Yes.
Yeah?
Yes. My favorite 4th of July story takes place in Alaska. And there was just this wonderful thing. I was in Alaska once for the 4th of July. I was driving around and I had gone to North Pole, Alaska, which is like a huge Santa's village up there. And I thought, well, you know, how appropriate is this? Drop in on Santa Claus on the 4th of July.
Yeah. So
I went over there and I, you know, saw his setup and swapped a few words with him, told him what I wanted for Christmas. And as I was driving away, I passed this little town, and they were selling fireworks on there were two fireworks stands on either side of the road. And one was one family, and the other was another family. And they were rival families, and they were having a war. And they were throwing fireworks at each other's fireworks stand.
Here, take that, a flower shoots by.
They were throwing lit fireworks?
They were throwing lit fireworks at each other's stand.
Black cats in the side of their garbage cans.
Yes, yes. And they were, like, one would run over and throw it at that one stand, the other one would run over and throw it at the other.
It's like
and I'm driving
hazard.
In between them. And as I'm driving in between them, they're both going, hey, come over here, buy our fireworks. And it's like, I'm not getting out of the
car. Bottle rocket shooting through your window.
I'm not getting out of the car. But these guys were, like, having the best time trying to blow up each other's fireworks stand. It was great. In Hawaii, like, I would go over to Hawaii for summer when I was a kid. That you can buy stacks. I'm not sure if you can, still can. You can buy stacks of firecrackers in the supermarket. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're like huge displays of black cats and Chinese firecrackers and everything.
We had those when I was a little girl, too.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Well, Michigan's so lush and green. I mean, can you still have firecrackers and fireworks?
Yeah.
Really?
Pretty much everywhere but California.
Oh.
Yeah, well, Michigan is so humid and wet. You know, you're lucky if you can even keep the fuse lit long enough to send it up. They do a nice display in Detroit down on the river.
And Emily, what were you talking about? The fireworks
racing Piccolo Pete's.
Oh yeah.
There you go. You set them down, and they both shoot off.
Well, actually, it was an accident the first time, but now it's become tradition.
Now, what's a Piccolo Pete for those folks who don't know what one is?
It's those little noisy ones.
The ones that make the highest pitch squeal.
Yeah,
and they are those the ones that spin? They look like little UFOs and go.
No, those are ground balloons.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Apparently, the Piccolo Pete scream while underwater, too.
Oh,
we
tied
a rock to it, like, suicide style, and threw it in the pool, and it was still screaming.
Wow.
Oh. Wow.
That's kind of morbid and sad.
Yeah, those are the
it's
fireworks.
It's the lobster of fireworks.
Those are the fireworks that everyone hears every 4th of July start off before it gets dark and goes, oh, come on, wait.
I heard one this afternoon on our street.
Oh, really?
And my sister looked at me. This was before my sister flew home. You know, she was here for 3 days. She just left. And said, aren't those illegal here? I said, oh, very.
Yeah.
She was like, oh, okay.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm in Northern California, and we couldn't have them up near San Francisco. But the farther north we drove, like to Sacramento, we'd start seeing the Red Devil stands. And if we went up to my Uncle Bill's house in Roseville, then there were, you could buy them up there. And I think the farther north you got toward Tahoe, you can get them anywhere, like Lake Tahoe. Mm-hmm. But I don't know if you can get them anymore. But they would, even then, they would restrict what you could get. You get sparklers, and you can get those nasty snakes. You know,
those aren't nasty. Those are awesome. They're awesome black snakes.
Yeah.
They even changed the sparklers from what I remember. They used to be a lot more sparkly.
Mm-hmm.
You can direct traffic with them and then have wand fights like you're in
Harry
Potter until you hit someone with one.
Yeah. Yeah, and I was little, you know, like shortly after Star Wars came out, so I can't tell you how many years we had lightsabers, sparklers.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, well, we were doing wand fights last 4th of July. Wand fights like we were Harry Potter.
Well, Harry Potter now, see? Yeah. It's just whatever pop culture, you know, kids are shooting magic
anything
wand.
Anything with a wand or stick that
there you
battle.
Go. Yes, absolutely.
Fiery sticks.
Yes, fire sticks.
Well, this is our 4th of July podcast.
It is indeed.
So,
well, happy, everybody.
Happy, be safe. Don't blow your arm off.
Yeah, right? Yeah. Don't shoot your eye out.
Don't shoot your eye out.
Don't light yourselves on fire. I hope that on July 5th you have all your digits and a smile on your face.
Happy 4th.
Happy 4th of July, a-holes!
Rashi, put that down! Rashi! Okay, everybody, duck and cover!
Whoa! This has been another episode of Radio Rashi. If you've enjoyed this episode, let everyone know by leaving a review in the iTunes store. It's a great way to help others find us. You can also leave comments on RadioRashi.com, Facebook.com/RadioRashi, or follow us on Twitter at Radio Rashi or at Paul_Dini to leave us questions. Thanks for listening, and tell your friends.
Hey, it's Paul again. Radio Rashi is going to Comic-Con this year. Listen next week for more details.